You're listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria, proudly improving health and care for everyone.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Taylor. I'm the Women's Health Programme Lead for Health Innovation Northeast and Northumbria, and I'm here with some of my esteemed colleagues to talk about women's health, about its impact on cardiovascular disease, and the role that inequalities in our communities play to the better screening, prevention and treatment of cardiovascular for the betterment of our region. So to introduce my colleagues, I have here Julia.
Hi, I'm Julia Newton. I'm Medical Director at Health Innovation Northeast Northumbria.
And we've got Syra.
Hi, I'm Syra Malik. I am a GP in Sunderland and I'm also the Northeast Northumbria Integrated Care Board Cardiovascular Disease Clinical Lead.
And Tracy.
Hi, I'm Tracy Marshall. I'm a CVD Programme Manager for Health Innovation Northeast Northumbria and I'm also a pharmacy technician by background.
So how big is this problem of cardiovascular disease in Northeast Northumbria then, Syra?
So I think it's a big problem, Julia. I think we know from the statistics we hold that there's 690 deaths every month in our region due to cardiovascular disease and its risk factors. That means that nearly 20% of the deaths in our region are due to heart and its blood vessel problems. One in four ladies die prematurely due to cardiovascular disease in our region, which is significantly high. And I think the most startling fact for me is that every 3 minutes, somebody dies in the country from a heart attack. So putting that into perspective, the talk that we've had alone that duration, one person may have died from a heart attack. I think what's now startlingly clear is that we know that women are affected by hormonal changes, menopause and lifestyle changes. So we've seen the rates of cardiovascular disease in women rise exponentially in our region. And I think that's quite concerning. And there's various reasons for that. So things like the symptoms that ladies experience when they're doing that hormonal change differ. So obviously I think we've all kind of read about the classic person who's having a heart attack, haven't we? And that tends to be a male who's overweight and smokes and drinks alcohol and they get the typical central crushing pain that goes up to their jaw or down the left arm. Whereas now the research that we do have, although albeit minimal that it is, it's now reporting that women get very short of breath, they get very tired, they get pain in their upper back. So that's not the classic symptoms that we've all been taught about. So obviously there's opportunities in which care might be missed or delivery of care might be missed.
So women tend to pitch up at their doctor complaining of different things compared to men. What does that ultimately lead to? What does that mean for women with cardiovascular disease?
I guess it means that there's more chances that they'll be misdiagnosed as not having a heart attack. They'll have a delay to their treatment. There's sequelae, as in they'll have more disability after the initial event has happened. And I think for me the big one is that we might miss the diagnosis, which is quite concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. So why do women get more cardiovascular disease compared to men then?
So I think on the whole, if you look at the statistics, men do have higher rates of cardiovascular disease because of those associated lifestyle factors such as weight, alcohol, smoking, reduced physical activity. But I think recent research has shown that women are catching up quite quickly, and that's mainly because of the menopausal changes, mainly because of hormonal changes and because of lifestyle. And there are risk factors now of alcohol and smoking as well, and weight plays a big part in cardiovascular disease. So as we know, our region has one of the highest obesity rates in the country now. So I think when you put all those risk factors together, especially with the hormonal and menopause changes women go through, it has quite a significant impact on their cardiovascular disease outcomes.
Okay, so with women and the menopause, what is it about the menopause that puts them more at risk?
So as we know, menopause means stopping of your periods, but actually we know that the hormonal roller coaster of change starts from 4 to 14 years for some women. So, women can go through a significant period of time where their hormones are being quite variable. And that change and that fluctuation of particularly your estrogen levels impacts on your body's ability to control cholesterol buildup, and obviously with that variation of hormones, it increases the risk of things like blood pressure going up, atherosclerotic disease, which means that you get the buildup of fat in your arteries going up as well.
So if you go on HRT then, does that take the risk away?
So HRT is a good option for women who are, possibly going through perimenopause or in menopause, because it does lower your risk. I can't give you the exact numbers on what the risk reduction is, because, again, we don't really have the exact figures or the statistics needed to answer that. But what I can say is that once you replace the estrogen, it should lower your risk. But we need to make sure that your cardiovascular disease risk factors are optimised at the same time, which means perhaps focusing on reducing or stopping smoking, drinking sensibly alcohol within the government's advised guidelines of 14 units per week, focusing on lifestyle, exercising, physical activity, and watching what you eat as well.
You know, what are the risks for women then, Sarah? You know, in terms of heart, if you don't have your blood pressure reduced, if you've got high blood pressure or you've got a high cholesterol level, what kind of magnitude of risk are we talking about?
So we know that there's many different risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So there's smoking, there is a raised BMI, which means that you're overweight. And I know that's a very sensitive topic in which we have to support our community with as well. But there's also alcohol intake. There's a genetic risk. So there's modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. Modifiable being those that we can do something about, which is stopping smoking, reducing alcohol intake, reducing body weight, reducing high blood pressure. And there's also non-modifiable risk factors. So things like genetics, and it runs in your family, so you have a higher risk. Or, for example, now we're talking about LPAs, which is a specific gene set, which means you have an increased risk of your hearts and your blood vessels being affected. So I think there's a chart, isn't it, the Healthy Hearts chart that me and Tracy were talking about earlier, and that shows that independently, most of these risk factors, if you manage to control them, raise your risk down by 5 to 10%, which feels reasonable and sensible. But actually, if you do have multiple problems such as COPD or asthma, you have rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory conditions as such, your weight is raised. If you smoke, if you think about that collaborative effect of those risk factors, I think just taking one in isolation wouldn't necessarily make the difference. We need to reduce down that individual risk. So we really need a holistic, whole personalized care approach to try and help individuals reduce down those risk factors as much as possible.
So if they do that through reducing their weights, stopping smoking, reducing alcohol, focusing on their diet and their physical activity, but that only gets you to about 10-20% of what you might need. If that's enough, what's next?
So I think if we've optimised the risk factors, but there is still a concern. So, for example, in general practice, we use the Q risk scoring tool, and that takes into account all of your potential risk factors and generates a percentage. So the government wants everybody who has a risk of 10% or more of having a heart attack or stroke in the coming 10 years to be on a statin. So we can use these tools in general practice alongside lifestyle modification to reduce down cholesterol levels. Obviously, there's lots of new innovations that we can employ nowadays, and I'll let my colleagues talk about that. But there's lots of tracking tools and devices that we can think of incorporating within the health service to try and help people optimize. But I think reducing down that risk even by 20% will have quite a pronounced effect on the outcomes of people dying from heart attacks and strokes.
Tracy, earlier when we were speaking, you used a really good description to explain Q risk scores and reducing, that 10% risk over 10 years.
So lay people, I guess, who don't work in this environment, that percentages, Q risk percent, doesn't really mean anything. So I kind of say that if So if I was talking to you, Julia, I'd say if there was 100 Julias in this room today that had exactly the same, you know, results as yourself, then if your Q risk was 10%, then potentially 10 of those Julias would go on to have a heart attack or a stroke in the next 10 years. And I think just putting that kind of personal spin on that and kind of making people think about it personally rather than as a percentage, because people don't think as a percentage is kind of, well, I don't know what that means. So I could kind of try and put that personal edge on it.
It does make people think, yeah, no, and that's a really good way of thinking about it. So if we've tried lifestyle advice and we're thinking about a Q risk score, so the next step's medicines, isn't it? And, you know, medicines for blood pressure, but if we is a good thing. And there are lots of really good evidence-based medicines for blood pressure. Cholesterol, the other big risk factor for which there's lots of medicines, sometimes gets bad press. Is there any reason why women should choose one type of tablet over another? Or, you know, is there any particular positive benefit for one tablet for women with CVD, cardiovascular disease, compared to other tablets?
No, so our clinical pathways are quite clear, both in the hospital and in the community, and that is that we use atorvastatin first line, and actually we know from kind of decades of research and use of the drug practically, I think the olden days of simvastatin are gone now, because I think they were known to cause side effects such as tiredness and muscle aches. But atorvastatin is first line, and it's used very, very well in the community. I mean, we will all have our own thoughts and concerns about taking medications. If somebody said to me, you're now going to be on a tablet every single night for life, I think I'd be a bit weary about what's going on. So I think, you know, alongside the obvious proven benefits of reducing your cholesterol, whether we do that through lifestyle modification or via tablets, I think it's just like you said before about enabling and empowering people to take control of their health, and that dictates the outcomes with the health that they will experience.
Absolutely, and I think there are lots of tablets and medicines, therapies for cholesterol now that have got very good evidence for them. So, you know, if ultimately men or women are offered a tablet, they shouldn't have any concerns about taking it.
I think I always say to my patients, don't knock it till you've tried it, because obviously I think when people go through that practical experience, you know, they learn on their healthcare journey whether something works for them or not. And you're right, I've just mentioned a statin there, but there are several different chemical agents now that we can use in the health service to help lower down your cholesterol, and they're very, very effective.
Yeah, now one of the things I heard recently was that women sometimes don't get offered treatment with tablets as frequently as men do. Is that right?
So the data, Tracy will back me up here, I think the data suggests that, doesn't it? It suggests that women are undertreated for raised cholesterols. I think we definitely need to do some more work into understanding why that is. It might be personal choice. It may be that the cholesterol levels vary. So I think, you know, I'm not going to make assumptions that I know what the underlying reason for it is, but I think we definitely need to do some more in-depth work looking at why that may be.
And then one of the other things I hear people talk about is that once you're on a tablet or even with lifestyle advice, sometimes people think that that's all they need to do, and they just go off, take the tablet, and that's enough. But again, my understanding is that there's a lot of data suggesting that people aren't treated to target. Well, what does that mean?
There are preferable target levels for your cholesterol. So we class people who haven't had a heart attack or a stroke as primary prevention, and people who have had a heart attack or a stroke or some kind of cardiovascular disease event as secondary prevention. And so there's different targets for those. It's more of a target for secondary prevention. So if you have had that heart attack or a stroke, we'd like that non-HDL, which is kind of the bad cholesterol, down to below, well, 2.6 or below. And that's to try and prevent recurrence of those cardiovascular events. With primary prevention, we like to see a reduction in their bad cholesterol as well. And it's to try and have that more protective effect on the heart. And statins do provide a protective effect on the heart as well. And I know we said there is more than just statins as well. We kind of say there's more tools in the toolbox. And it's something that we've been trying to do more in the secondary prevention space, but it's becoming more prevalent in the primary prevention space, to, again, get people to know their numbers and get them to ask, what is my target? Where should I be? So we've trialled putting information on their tablet, their medication tablets as well. And I think if people kind of are informed and know what their target should be and where they should be, what we'd like to do now is to kind of ensure patients kind of know their target and what we'd like, if they are taking medication and making lifestyle choices, and inform them that they do need to kind of be reviewed and monitored as well, and that it is going to be a lifelong thing. Some people say, well, if I take my tablets and I get down to target, can I stop taking them then? Mm-hmm. The advice is no, because as soon as you kind of stop taking that medication, your cholesterol levels will start to kind of creep back up again. So it is a lifestyle change. But I also say that having a heart attack or a stroke is life-limiting or life-changing as well. And it's, you know, which would you kind of prefer? Mm. So yes, we are trying to kind of educate people about their targets and why it's so important. And I always say that the blood test or the finger prick test is just the catalyst, and it should just be the catalyst to the conversation, because it's, for me, it's the education around the targets, why it's important, why are you more at risk than somebody, you know, your neighbour or whatever, because people do listen to other people's information. But it's about trying to give that that tailored approach to that person that you have in front of you.
So would the target be the same for a man and a woman?
Yes, it would be, yeah.
And there's no difference with age, so before menopause or after menopause, it wouldn't make any difference what your target was?
No, there's different targets for good cholesterol, but that's, we know we, the higher the good cholesterol, you know, it's good to have that good cholesterol. We all need the cholesterol in our bodies. But as far as kind of reducing those bad fats, those bad cholesterol, no, it's the same.
Great. And where would you recommend that people get information from if they want to empower themselves?
There's lots of resources out there. So obviously there's a Health Innovation website. We've got lots of resources on our websites. Predominantly for healthcare professionals, for patients and public. There's some fantastic resources on the Heart UK website, the British Heart Foundation website, the NHS website as well. So that's signposts to smoking cessation. And obviously it, from the NHS website as well, depending on what you're looking for, it will then signpost you elsewhere as well. So there's loads of resources out there. Your GP practice, your pharmacy, your local pharmacy, they're, as Sarah said earlier, they're kind of big advocates within their community, and they will be able to kind of be able to give you those health messages as well. I know that the ICB have done blood pressure kiosks as well across North Cumbria. And they're in community settings as well. I think those health messages and those health testing are becoming more available within communities.
You have been listening to the Innovation in Healthcare podcast, produced by Health Innovation North East and North Cumbria. If you'd like to find out more about our women's health strategy, please visit the Improving Population Health page on our website at healthinnovationnenc.org.uk. We will, of course, provide further links and resources in the podcast show notes. Thank you for listening.